morning, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to Division 5 of the Colorado Court of Appeals. We have three matters to hear today, two on the 9 o'clock docket. The first is O'Neill against, is it Wolpoff?
Yes, sir.
And the second is Carvajal against State Farm. Our counsel here on that case as well.
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. You've received an information sheet that gives you some insight as to the procedures today. We have read the briefs in the cases. We're well aware of the facts. If that helps in streamlining your presentation to the court, so be it. At least one of us has been under the record, so we're well aware of the factual background of the case. You have 15 minutes aside. When the yellow light comes on, 5 minutes remain for rebuttal, to the extent that you want rebuttal as appellant. I would ask that people please turn off pagers and cellular telephones at this time. And with that request, counsel, you may proceed.
Good morning, Your Honors, counsel. I'm Paul Miller, and I'm here on behalf of William O'Neill, and I want to thank you for your attention this morning. I would appreciate the courtesy of accepting the supplemental authority that I filed with the court on Saturday, and I apologize for that, but in my defense, that authority apparently was not in the possession of the district court when the district court entered its summary judgment order. I don't believe that that order would have resulted from the Denver District Court had the Denver District Court given enough attention to the jurisdiction of the United States District Court for the District of Colorado.
Actually, Mr. Biller, we're not going to accept the supplemental authority for a couple of reasons. Number one, it's late. But number two, 28J specifies quite clearly that new authority should be the subject of supplemental filings, and neither of the cases in your supplemental filing are new.
No, sir. The origins of those cases go back to 1804.
Yes.
And so I could not, with good conscience, tell the court that the supplemental authority is new.
Well, Mr. Miller, let me ask at the outset, what about Judge Krieger's order is confusing in this case? Her order specifically says, on the basis of having obviously read the settlement agreement, that the TCPA claims are reserved.
That's a contract claim, and we prevail on that. Yes? The court clearly said that the TCPA claims are not to be disposed of under the jurisdiction that she asserted in that case, and that jurisdiction was strictly under 28 U.S.C. Section 1331.
Okay.
The case law, and nobody disputes the fact that the federal courts do not have jurisdiction of TCPA claims under 1331. It's outside of that. And in fairness to Judge Krieger, she specified she didn't have to put that in her order.
Doesn't that resolve the matter?
It should. We won.
All right.
And that's why I say the summary judgment of the district court focused on the bifurcated subordinate clause of the doctrine of res judicata. There are two parts. Was decided and could have been decided. We won on the was decided portion, and they argued it could have been decided, and at the district court level, Wolpoff won.
Let me ask a follow-up question. I noticed that nowhere in the record is there a copy of the signed settlement agreement. However, there is a copy of the settlement agreement attached to the complaint. Is that the version that was executed in this case?
That was the one that was drafted. I don't have an executed one. They filed their motion with the Denver District Court before they executed that.
But it was ultimately executed?
Yes. I'm going to qualify that. I don't recall that I have an executed copy, sir.
All right.
Well, Mr. Miller, is there a settlement agreement or not?
Oh, yes. And the judge's order dealing with the TCPA claims says that they were reserved. Thank you, Your Honor. Are there any other questions? I reserve whatever time I have left.
You've got about 10 minutes and 36 seconds.
Well, I don't think I'll need that much. Thank you, Jen.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court, Ronald Cantor, appearing pro hoc vice, on behalf of the law firm of Wolpoff and Abramson, appellee in this case. I'd like to address the question of the settlement agreement that was just mentioned. There was no signed settlement agreement. The agreement was consummated during an extended telephone call where there were five lawyers on the line. My client's lawyer in the federal court was John Phillips. Mr. Miller represented Mr. O'Neill, and there were three lawyers from the appellee law firm as parties and, of course, as attorneys. And the testimony before the magistrate judge went into detail as to what was discussed. Judge Krieger, in her decision, talks about the testimony but notes that Mr. O'Neill never ordered the transcripts. The transcript's not part of the record. But let me tell you, let me get to the point of how this settlement agreement was made and how it broke down, causing a motion to be filed. There was an agreement to settle the first amended complaint for a monetary payment of damages plus attorney fees. After that's concluded, and it went back and forth for, I think, over an hour. After that's concluded, then counsel for Mr. O'Neill says, well, what about my TCPA claim? I can tell you that certainly that was a big surprise, because when you bring claims, you settle them. And in fact, if you look at Judge Krieger's decision, it talks about a, quote, global settlement, that the testimony was the parties intended a global settlement. So rather than saying, okay, this is going to be a do-over, we're walking away, my client said, fine, we settle this. You can exclude your TCPA claims. And that was the agreement. It was never memorialized in a written contract because a motion was required to be filed to enforce it.
The difficulty that we have is we have a record presented to us without any transcripts. But we do have an order of the court. And we also have a form of settlement agreement, albeit not signed. It is difficult for us to see exactly what the trial court relied upon in coming to her order, but we do have the order, and the order is quite specific. The order says, in no uncertain terms, that the TCPA claims are excluded. And I don't see any request to modify that order in any respect.
No, there was not. But by excluding a claim from a settlement, it does not mean that the party agreeing to that exclusion therefore waived their right in the subsequent action to defend based on the doctrine of claims preclusion. Claims preclusion is a principle of judicial economy. You bring all of your claims in one action. The four elements have all been met, and we submit that the district court properly entered summary judgment. The first element requires the finality of the prior case, and there was a final judgment on the merits. Mr. O'Neill had filed a first amended complaint and moved to dismiss that first amended complaint. Secondly, the second element, identity of subject matter. The identity of the subject matter is these unwanted, purported unwanted calls to his cell phone. In the federal court action, the cause was a consumer protection statute under federal law, the Fair Debt Collection Practices Act. So there's an identity of the subject matter, because in this case in state court, the same injury is complained of, unwarranted calls to his cell phone. The third element requires there to be an identity of claims for relief. The Supreme Court in the Michelson case has said this element is determined by the injury complained of and not by the theory advanced. The injury complained of is identical, calls to the cell phone. The first cause of action was under a federal consumer protection statute. The second cause of action is under a related federal statute and is barred by the doctrine of claims preclusion. Finally, the fourth element is met. There's no dispute. There's an identity of the parties. So that...
Counsel, pardon me for interrupting you.
Pardon me?
Pardon me for interrupting you.
Oh, sure. No, no.
But I guess I'm having trouble getting something, and I need you to help me. The federal district court order takes the TCPA claim off of the table. It says, we're not resolving that here. And in fact, it makes it clear that not only are we not resolving it here, but I think that the language makes it clear that you shouldn't try to use this order to prevent this claim from being brought in state court. With such clarity in the federal order, how can we possibly say that this particular claim is precluded?
Because I believe there is a distinction between an agreement that, in essence, that part of the agreement lacks consideration. You can't split a cause of action. So if a plaintiff says, I've got $10,000 in medical bills, and I demand a settlement of $30,000, and they then settle it for $30,000, and then at the last moment, after it's settled, the plaintiff comes in and says, wait a minute, what about my $5,000 in additional medical bills? It's an arm-length transaction. There's no consideration for excluding that $5,000.
So are you saying that we should ignore the language in the order?
No. No, there's no question you can't. But you don't have to ignore the language in the order to understand or to interpret it as authorizing the filing of a claim, but not at the same point making a judicial determination as to whether it is proper to bring that second claim. Only that in terms of the settlement, there was a negotiation that broke down and ultimately wound up in an agreement, fine, you bring your TCPA claims. And frankly, the reason that my clients agreed to that is they recognized from the beginning it was a splitting of the cause of action problem that the plaintiff would have.
So are you saying that you can't structure a settlement in such a way that it will allow the raising of the additional claim, or are you saying that it just wasn't done in this case?
I believe I'm saying certainly it wasn't done in this case. There was nothing in writing that says my client agrees not to assert defenses they would otherwise have to the bringing of the TCPA claim by excluding it from the settlement. Now, there is a case that's been cited in the briefs, and I believe it was cited by the judge in the district court. It's the Block 170, Denver versus Block 173 Associates case. What happened there was a federal claim that was disposed of, and then the plaintiffs brought state law claims in state court, and the defense was made, you've got claims preclusion. What happened in that particular case is the court said no, because they had no opportunity to bring those claims in federal court. These were state law claims, and they only arose after the federal court had dismissed the federal claims. Henceforth, there would have been no supplemental jurisdiction. So under that scenario, claims preclusion wouldn't apply because they could not have been brought. Here, clearly, they could have been brought. Mr. O'Neill filed a second amended complaint seeking to bring them.
But is that really the test, Mr. Hines? Here, while it's possible that he could have brought the claims, assuming that for the sake of argument, the trial court made the following statements. Number one, the settlement agreement specifically excluded the claims. Number two, the TCPA claims were not part of this settlement. Number three, as to the claims under the Telephone Consumer Protection Act, the settlement agreement explicitly does not resolve such claims, and this is the important part, and does not prevent plaintiff from asserting such claims in the future. Now, if we are to accept your position, it seems to me that it would fly in the face of a specific order of the trial court to the contrary.
I suggest there's a distinction between preserving the right to bring the claim and the legal consequences of bringing that claim in a second proceeding. And, you know, I don't want to be too cute about this, but, you know, in the settlement negotiations, which never resulted in a signed agreement, but for which there was testimony, there was an acknowledgement that if he wants to bring his claims, we're going to let him bring his claims because they're barred by claims preclusion. They're barred by splitting a cause of action. And that's the case. And there's no way, Your Honors, that I suggest you can ignore or change or modify what Judge Krieger said. All I'm saying is, taking what she said in context, it says we're excluding these claims from the settlement agreement. They may be brought. But that is not the same thing as saying, as ruling that it would be proper to bring them despite the doctrine of claims preclusion. It was a contentious settlement negotiation, and this was the outcome of it. Now, the record does show that Mr. O'Neill did in fact try to bring his TCPA claims in federal court in a second amended complaint. His second amended complaint also included state claims for malicious prosecution, invasion of privacy, and outrageous conduct. The court refused to grant leave because he had filed it too late. But it's somewhat remarkable that Mr. O'Neill is now saying, well, the court didn't have federal jurisdiction over my TCPA claims. They in fact did. They had supplemental jurisdiction. Although this federal statute does not confer original jurisdiction for federal question purposes over federal courts, I've cited case law that where there are other bases of federal jurisdiction, i.e. supplemental jurisdiction or diversity, federal courts will hear these TCPA claims. So I suggest that Judge Krieger's order should be read that, yes, these claims are excluded and they may be brought, but that order does not prevent or restrain the party who willingly agreed to exclude them from asserting a defense based on a principle of law that's well established and based upon a principle of law that is intended to require all claims to be brought at one time for the purpose of ensuring judicial economy.
Now, Wright and Miller seem to disagree with you. Wright and Miller take the following position that basically, the contractual nature of consent judgments has led to a general agreement that preclusive effects should be measured by the intent of the parties. Is it wrong for us to divine the intent of the parties in this case based upon the U.S. District Court's understanding of that intent when she entered her order?
Oh, you're talking about a consent judgment. I think this was a little bit different in the sense it wasn't a judgment. It was a settlement agreement that was enforced. That I'm not saying that you need to do that, but what I'm saying is the fact that a party agrees to allow a claim to be brought should not bar their ability to defend that either on any basis, whether it be factual or legal. And it would be peculiar, I would suggest, if the court were to say parties can split a cause of action merely because there was an acknowledgement that parts of the claim were not in the settlement. I don't think that that is a rule that would be wise to adopt, because you still have the paramount question, the paramount issue. You need to bring your claims all in one action. And I think that's what the district court judge did on summary judgment. The district court, we respectfully suggest, properly applied the doctrine of claims preclusion, properly analyzed Judge Krieger's order, consistent with its terms, to allow the bringing of the action, but not to countenance or not to license the action moving forward without the right to defend it on the basis it should have been brought earlier. And it is on that basis we ask that the court affirm the judgment. Thank you.
Mr. Miller?
Your Honors, I appreciate the nature and the quality of the questions that were addressed to both of us. There were a couple issues that were raised by Mr. Cantor that I believe need to be addressed in oral arguments. And his concept of the $10,000, $30,000illustration that he gave the court must be looked at in the context of the jurisdiction of the United States District Court. On numbers like that, the district court only has jurisdiction on diversity, provided that the threshold of $75,000 is met. In the particular case that we're dealing with right now, the TCPA claims did not meet the $75,000 threshold. The additional claims that were asserted were the emotional distress damages that we felt we could prove in order to meet that minimum jurisdiction of $75,000 and to keep all of the cases in one court. Now, the other thing, backing up, the United States District Court did not even have diversity jurisdiction until February, 3 months before the settlement. That diversity jurisdiction was only given to the federal court in a case involving iHire, and that opinion came out, like I said, in February. Prior to that period of time, the law in the United States District Court for the District of Colorado was issued by the district court, and that holding in Consumer Crusade said that the exclusive forum for the enforcement of the entire TCPA was the state courts of Colorado. There's a judicial bar to us bringing any TCPA claim in the federal court, and that's the law of the federal courts. The other part of it is, and I again would request this court to consider the supplemental authority, because Counsel Cantor could have put the supplemental authority into Judge Krieger's record. The supplemental authority says that if it's not in Judge Krieger's record, it doesn't exist. The court did not have supplemental jurisdiction because of a procedural deficiency that goes to the doorstep of the law office of Wolpoff, and they simply forgot to put into Judge Krieger's record the jurisdictional element that almost 200 years of jurisprudence says has to be in a federal record. Now they want to turn around and say, but it could have been decided if we would have put that jurisdiction in Judge Krieger's record. They didn't. And with that, Your Honors, again, I want to thank you for your time and your consideration, and trust that since we did try our best to join these cases, and that because of the jurisdictional limits and the preferences of the United States Court in having TCPA matters handled by the state courts of Colorado, and considering the natures of these claims, I will trust that you will reverse and remand and let us have our day in court. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Miller. Thank you, Mr. Cantor, and I apologize for calling you Mr. Himes during the course of the argument. I won't do that again. The